Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, God's own house. Speaking of windows. And letting our popular Latin lover loose in the Himalayas. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. God's own house, a church, we may read in our dictionary, is a building set aside and dedicated for purposes of divine worship, the place of assembly for a worshipping community. And when we do have a church, there are certain essentials we expect to find. Four walls, a roof, and as Jill Bevilacqua chooses to illustrate, plenty of windows. Stay tuned.
But let my dew feet never fail to walk the studious cloisters pale and love the high endowed roof with antique pillars massy proof and storied windows richly dight, casting a dim religious light.
Milton was writing in the 16th century when storied windows were common enough for people to know what he meant, although he was coining a new word. But unlike Byzantine church windows, which were glazed from an early period, in England, glass didn't appear until about the 13th century. Even palaces didn't have glass in every window. There's a record of an order for window glass by Henry III, so that the chamber may not be so windy. So windows in early churches were merely spaces, small and high up, filled with horn, oiled linen, or even wooden shutters to keep out wind and draughts. In the 12th century, they started to splay them, or widen the aperture, to bring more light into the church. When glass was introduced, stained or painted in bright colours, church windows became veritable religious picture galleries. The Poor Man's Bible, as those by the choir at Canterbury have been called, proved a most effective way of bringing scripture to the unlettered masses. They were also a visual aid for the preacher, who no longer had to rely on his own eloquence, or the lack of it. George Herbert, the 17th century metaphysical poet and Anglican clergyman, was of this mind. Comparing the preacher himself to a window, he suggests the ideal situation, colour and light from the windows, and a preacher infused with God's life.
Lord, how can man preach thy eternal word? He is a brittle, crazy glass. Yet in thy temple thou dost him afford this glorious and transcendent place to be a window through thy grace. But when thou dost anneal in glass thy story, making thy life to shine within the holy preacher's, then the light and glory more reverend grows and more doth win, which else shows waterish, bleak and thin. Doctrine and life, colours and light, in one when they combine and mingle, bring a strong regard and awe. But speech alone doth vanish like a flaring thing, and in the ear not conscience ring.
In these windows glowing with colour, scenes and personalities from both Old and New Testament were shown. Prophets, patriarchs and kings, the angel Gabriel or Christ in glory. At York, the Great East Window uses scenes from Genesis and Revelation to depict the beginning and end of the world. This window, which is 80 feet high and 30 feet wide, has the world's largest area of medieval stained glass to be contained in a single window. Flemish and English glaziers made the stained glass of the windows of King's College Chapel in Cambridge. Scenes from the Old and New Testament run all round the chapel, telling the Christian story, beginning and ending with Our Lady, patroness of the college. The New Testament scenes in the lower halves of the windows, culminating in the crucifixion in the east window, are linked with the Old Testament scenes above. The adoration of the Magi is prefigured by the Queen of Sheba's visit to King Solomon, the resurrection by Jonah's escape from the whale. During the Second World War, all the stained glass in the chapel was removed for safety. And today, back in place, is still intact and brilliant after 400 years. Every year, millions of visitors come to gaze on these windows. But the marvels of stained glass are to be found not only in the great cathedrals, but even in the humblest of parish churches. And the pleasure it can give is often of a surprising nature. Here, Marcel Proust is writing of his favourite church.
Its windows were never so brilliant as on days when the sun scarcely shone, so that if it was dull outside, you might be certain of fine weather in church. And all of them were so old that you could see here and there their silvery antiquity sparkling with the dust of centuries and showing in its threadbare brilliance the very cords of their lovely tapestry of glass. There was one among them which was a tall panel composed of 100 little rectangular windows, of blue principally. The next instant, it had taken on all the iridescence of a peacock's tail, then shook and wavered in a flaming and fantastic shower, distilled and dropping from the groin of the dark and rocky vault down the moist walls, as though it were along the bed of some rainbow grotto of sinuous stalactites. A moment later, the little lozenge windows had put on the deep transparence, the unbreakable hardness of sapphires clustered on some enormous breastplate, but beyond which could be distinguished, dearer than all such treasures, a fleeting smile from the sun, which would console me for the blackness and bareness of the earth outside by making burst into blossom, as in some springtime in old history, this dazzling and gilded carpet of forget-me-nots in glass.
A stained glass window is defined as a translucent mosaic held together by lead. In the Middle Ages, glass was made from potash left by the burning of wood mixed with sand. With the addition of metallic oxides, molten glass could be stained blue, green, brown, mauve, or ruby. Only ruby presented a problem. It always turned black in the light. But then the glassblowers found a solution. A man would work two kilns of metal side by side, dip his blowpipe into the white glass, bring out a mass of white, and dip it quickly into the liquid ruby. He'd then blow the whole together so that the white ended up with a coat of ruby, and through this the light would penetrate.
I stepped into a pit of momentary darkness, and then found myself treading a clear floor of stone in a trenchant reservoir of light. The walls drove up sheer out of the mind's reach, on either side of the wings of vaulting, hushed above my head. High in the walls were stretched out the agonized stained windows, breaking up the light into a sorrowful murmur of tones. The air was frozen wine, built up of the window colors, colored ice that penetrated and knocked hard on the bones and picked out every hair on the body.
V.S. Pritchett, writing about León Cathedral in Spain. And what about the mosaic and the lead? Well, the artist, who had no paper, drew his design on a whitewashed table, cut his coloured glass pieces with a red-hot pointed iron, known as a crozing iron, then outlined his picture on the glass with a dark pigment and filled in the details. And another thing, when he cut his pieces, he'd choose them so that the flaws in the glass could be exploited to the greatest artistic effect. For as the experts tell us, it is these very bubbles, grits of sand, streaks and variations in thickness that give the glass its unique light-catching magic. As time went on and methods improved, craftsmen found that a design could be painted on white glass and then burnt in. Later still, pictures were painted on clear glass using enamel colours. Although the medieval English made some glass, the best glass was always imported, for example, from Chartres, where the purity of the river sand was legendary. But then the whole art of glassmaking was surrounded in mystery, as one writer comments.
Lost in the shadowy silence of canopied Renaissance stalls, in blazing glass above the dark, glow skies and thrones and wings, blue, ruby, gold and green between the whiteness of the walls. And countless congregations, as the generations pass, join choir and great crowned organ case in centuries of song, to praise eternity contained in time and coloured glass.
John Betjeman, writing of King's College, Cambridge. A popular church decoration was the Jesse window. This was a design showing the descent of our Lord from the royal line of David, whose father was Jesse. From the recumbent figure of Jesse springs the tree, in whose branches appear the chief figures in the line of descent, ending in the figure of our Lord, or the Virgin and Child. Though there are sculptured Jesses over doorways, in Amiens, for example, the design was used chiefly in windows. The cathedrals of Chartres and Wells have Jesse windows, and the old church of Dorchester in Oxfordshire. This has a 600-year-old east window, a colourful picture gallery with small groups of sculptured figures across the bottom. In the Jesse window, apart from the coloured figures in the glass, there are 24 carved in stone on the mullions, in between each pane and at the sides.
And there shall come forth a rod out of the root of Jesse, and a flower shall rise up out of his root, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of fortitude, the Spirit of knowledge and of godliness, and he shall be filled with the Spirit of the fear of the Lord.
But of all the windows ever made for churches, there is none to compare with the rose window, which appeared at the same time as the Gothic style. It followed the wheel window of the Romanesque period, which had itself evolved from the plain round holes of earlier churches. When some of these were enlarged to let in more light, the wind and rain came in as well. So a primitive form of glass was added, held in a frame, which was usually in the form of a cross. From this, it was an easy transition to the wheel, just a question of adding a few spokes. And when stained glass arrived and the design became more geometrical to accommodate it, the wheel became a rose. Sometimes both wheel and flower coexisted in the same window. At Chartres, the west rose is externally a massive wheel, internally a perfect flower. Similarly, at Amiens, the wheel of fortune on the outside became a rose full of fire within. The rose window, writes Paint and Cowan in his book on the subject, answered a perennial human need for a symbol of divine and cosmic unity. And every rose window, he writes, from the largest cathedral to the smallest chapel, is the symbol of love. At the centre of all the rose windows in Chartres Cathedral is Christ as the source of all energy. But, Cowan tells us, it's the great west rose window, over 14 metres in diameter, which is still, to some people, the standard by which all others are judged. While most of the great rose windows are in France, the home of Gothic, there are spectacular wheel windows in Italy, in Orvieto, Assisi, Todi. They evoke Ezekiel's vision. Their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Although the era of rose windows was over by the 16th century, there has been a revival in modern times. Paint and Cowan believes that the finest of these is probably that of Washington Cathedral in the USA.
The cathedral was built entirely in Gothic style, using the original building methods, and contains three rose windows built in traditional form, which exploit to the full the possibilities afforded by modern glass techniques.
But when all is said and done, the windows of a church, however beautiful, can never be more than a means to an end. In these lines, entitled In a Country Church, the Welsh poet R.S. Thomas offers his perception of the essential reality.
To one kneeling down, no word came, only the wind's song, saddening the lips of the grave saints, rigid in glass, or the dry whisper of unseen wings, bats, not angels, in the high roof. Was he balked by silence? He kneeled long and saw love in a dark crown of thorns blazing, and a winter tree golden with fruit of a man's body.
Our thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for this delightful programme. Meanwhile, it's time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Mind the change of pace and tone. Were the Romans environmentalists, do you think?
No. I mean, they saw some things had to be done, you know, like canals built and...
strained.
Yeah, that they understand. But, you know, world climate and world warming, they didn't.
Well, they wouldn't have. They wouldn't have screamed from rooftops that God,
no,
that
no.
God is green.
No, no,
how'd
no.
How'd you say that in Latin?
What, that God is green? It was really disaster.
They wouldn't have screamed from rooftops.
Domorum fastigius. Non exclamavisent. They would not have screamed, Deus vidi disest, God is green. They would not have done that. Well, no one understood that stuff in those days.
Well, maybe the Stoics would have done, because they had...
Well, they had a vision of the world complex, the Stoics did.
Mm.
But I don't know about ecology, I don't know.
They believed in the...
The totality of creation, they did. Mm. Yes, they did.
Were there lots of Stoics around in Roman times?
Oh, there always were. Of course, Seneca was the big one.
Mm.
The big Roman representative of Stoicism.
Okay, well, let's dedicate this piece to Seneca. I'm going to take you to the rooftop of the world. What's that?
Where is that?
The Himalaya.
Okay.
How do you say the rooftop?
In Orbis... Kakumine. Orbis Kakumine, in the highest point of the world.
I'm going to tell you something that will make your skin crawl.
Huh.
How do you say making one's skin crawl in Latin?
What does that mean?
Feeling uncomfortable, it makes you cringe, I don't know.
Faccia ad nescio ego nescio. Bene, go on.
You won't answer my questions. I'm going to speak about the Himalaya melting. Glacial lakes, this is an article I found, pose a new peril as ice turns to water.
Mm.
So how do you say that?
Lacus glaciales novum afferunt periculum. Ice turns to water.
Yeah.
Glaciae in aquam transiunte. Ice turning over into water.
This is an alarm. This is a real alarm. This is serious stuff. How do you say this is serious stuff? It's a real alarm.
Roxime seria.
Alarm? How do you say alarm?
Est admonitio gravissima. I don't know anything about the Himalayas.
In 1994, a mile-long glacial lake near Bhutan's border with Tibet ruptured catastrophically. And how do you say rupturing catastrophically?
Oh, my Lord. What is the lake ruptus est in calamitatem?
Mm. Over a period of several hours, just think, the entire lake, more than a billion cubic feet of water, emptied out, sending a rampaging torrent down valley that swept away an artisan's colony near the town of Punaka, killing 23 people. Okay, let's just translate. More than a billion cubic feet of water emptied out.
I just say a billion. You can't say this. Well, you can say it in Latin. You can almost say blah, 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 blah.
You can write it.
You can write it. You can say Milena, Milia, cuborum, cuborum, aquae, evacuae facta sunt. We're emptied.
Emptied out, sending a rampaging torrent down valley that swept away the village.
Torrentem devastantem in valem direxerunt.
Global warming has forced into retreat virtually all of these thousands of glaciers.
Hey, global warming, there you go. Calefactio planetae. In recessum coagit. What the?
Has forced into retreat.
Yes.
Global warming has forced into retreat virtually all of these glaciers, which are shrinking.
Denique tandem omnes. Glaciarum moles. These are glaciers.
During the Little Ice Age, which ended as recently as 150 years ago, glaciers slowly bulldozed horseshoe-shaped rubble and ice down valley. Let's translate. Little ice age.
Many parva glaciae etas.
Changing the subject. The Romans had ice houses, didn't they?
No.
Yes, they did.
They kept ice in ice.
In the Alps.
They kept ice. They took it from the snow and they put it into
ice. I understand, but they had ice houses like the Eskimos is another story.
No, I mean houses where they kept ice.
Oh, ice houses, not ice houses. Well, yeah, they used the ice in their wine and they imported ice. And you were supposed to put ice in your wine.
They eat ice
cream. Cool. Oh, yeah. Oh, they had all that stuff.
Lemon sorbets.
Yeah, sorbets, yeah. I don't know how they kept the ice. They kept it in salt or something like that. Anyway, they would bring in ice, there's no question about it.
Getting back to our little ice age, glaciers slowly bulldozed horseshoe-shaped rubble and ice down valley. Moraines. Horseshoe-shaped moraines. Too difficult.
Well, it's not, you can describe it. Propellerunt terram et solum informam calcei equini. A horse's shoe, which means nothing, of course.
Well, it's curved.
Yeah, okay.
The moraine, which is this rubble, this material, is turned into the geologic equivalent of Swiss cheese.
Oh, my Lord, deliver us. Icterum transfigurator in id quod, into that which casus helveticus digitur, is called Swiss cheese.
It's sad.
Oh, that's enough.
It's terrible, isn't it? I told you it would make your skin crawl.
You can do it. You just have to think for a moment, heaven's sakes alive.
Now, let's go for a walk in the Himalaya now. We wander through lush yak meadows.
And what is yak? I don't know what a yak is.
We wander through lush meadows. How'd you say that?
Florida, ambulamos per prata.
Ravens clack and prattle.
Oh, Lord, deliver us. Ravens are what? Corvi. Crocant. Corvi crocant et.
Waffle.
It's a blatterant. That's not the right word, but anyway.
As they wheel above us.
Circumvolantes, that's all right.
And I scan the surrounding peaks with my binoculars.
Et perspicillo meo. Per lustro apices circumdantes. That I can say.
Okay. Are you concerned about the environment?
No, I don't feel it. I'm sorry.
What worries you most about the environment? The lack of water that we're going to get? Or flooding?
I don't know this. I don't know this. Here in Rome, I just don't see it. I don't see this. I don't see the emergency. From the newspapers, everyone's talking about this. And they had pictures the other day how low the Tiber is. It's lower now than it is. Should be. It was in August. Well, then, of course, you say, ooh, I don't know what's going on.
Claudius built a channel to go to the port of Ostia, didn't he?
He built a harbour out at Ostia. Where he sunk the famous ship there as a lighthouse. He didn't build a channel. He built a harbour out there. He extended the harbor of Ostia, like the river, and he put a whole new thing out there, which they discovered a few years ago, you know. You know, the famous ship that brought the obelisk at St. Peter's?
Mm-hmm.
That was Caligula, and they built the biggest ship in the world transport this thing. You didn't know this?
No, I never know anything.
From Alexandria, Cairo, and Egypt, down the Nile, up to Rome. Well, they had about 25,000 bushels of lentils or something as ballast.
Wow.
It was the biggest ship in the world. To get that thing at St. Peter's Square here to Rome. About 40 tons or whatever the thing is, I don't even know. Which Caligula did. And of course the ship is sitting there. They got the thing and they got the obelisk here in the Circus of Nero, parallel to St. Peter's Basilica today. But anyway, this ship is sitting out there, and Ostia was sitting there, this massive thing, the biggest ship in the world. Well, Claudius, intelligent man, said, I'm going to use this ship as part of my breakwater. No, he was going to build this new harbor, which he did. And he said, part of the breakwater way out there, I'm going to sink this ship and put a lighthouse on it, which is extremely intelligent.
Was that the first lighthouse ever?
Yeah, I mean, for the Romans, yes.
How does one say lighthouse?
Pharos, which of course, Pharos in the east, one of the wonders of the world. And so Claudius had this ship sunk with stones and everything else and supported below with pillars. You can't believe this thing. It's all described in Suetonius. And then he had a tower put, instead of like the mast of the ship, he had a tower put up there. And on the top of the tower, he had a place for fires. And at night, he had people lighting fires up there so that the ships coming in could see the fire and direct their journey into the harbor.
How do you say all that in Latin?
Oh, I'm not going to say it all right now. And the fact is, if you go to Ostia right now, you can see mosaics there, you know, in the square of the corporations. And you see this thing like an island and this tower and fires up on top. And those were the fires of Claudius's lighthouse out at Ostia. They found about a few years ago, they found some of the foundations of these things out in the water. Oh, out of this world. It was extremely intelligent. He didn't know what to do with his ship. And so he sunk the whole thing like an island. It was so big. He sunk the thing and put a lighthouse on the top with fires there. And he said, you know, incendius or something. Navicola dirigerentur. That the ships would be, or navicolae, would be directed by the fires on the top of the tower. And you can still see, as I say, in Ostia, if you go out there, you see these mosaics all over the place. And one of the symbols, almost like a postage stamp, of Ostia, was this, like an island with this tower and the fires up on top, which was Claudius's lighthouse. And we're so smart today, we're not smart at all.
Yeah, well, we would need the Romans to deal with our environmental problem. How do you say that?
Ejeremus hodie Romanus qui difficultatem nostram ambituum locorum solverent.
They would solve our problems. They would have found a solution to
They were very practical.
To the lakes.
Very, very practical.
In the Himalayas.
They weren't philosophical like the Greeks, you know, and art and dancing and all music. They didn't understand that stuff. But they were extremely practical.
They were engineers, in a sense. The engineer mentality.
And the organizers and laws and streets and all that stuff. Ooh, the Romans were good.
Hartel, thanks there once again to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.